Welcome to Wild Hearts at Work, a podcast redefining our relationship with work through stories and conversations with wild hearts who have dared to challenge the status quo. And now, here's your host, Melissa Boggs.
Hello, friends, and welcome to the Wild Hearts at Work podcast. I am your host, Melissa Boggs. And this week, our phrase is a lot of syllables, so many syllables that I almost choked on them the first time I said it, but it is participatory budgeting. And I am really excited to have someone on the podcast who is super passionate about this and probably knows the most.
And he loves every syllable.
Every syllable that almost choked me to death. Welcome to the podcast, Luke Homan. Luke, I love this. When I asked Luke what he did, he says he provides positive energy to systems that need it. Welcome to the podcast, Luke. Tell us about yourself.
Hi, everyone.
Hello.
Hello.
So tell us what this means to provide positive energy to systems that need it. And then eventually tell us how it relates to our phrase of the week.
Absolutely. We all participate in a large number of systems. We have our family systems and our work systems, our community systems, our civic systems. We live in different parts of the world. Those parts of the world have different cultural systems. And human systems can kind of sometimes be energy creating among each other. And sometimes they can be energy draining. Maybe the workplace isn't quite what I want, or maybe my home environment isn't quite what I want, or my community is starting to lose some cohesiveness, or even a school, especially in this horrific pandemic when kids are no longer having the opportunity to form the relationships that they would by being together. There's a lot of systems and they can create or need energy. And I like to think of myself, I don't always know if I do, but I like to think of myself as trying to find the systems that need a little positive energy. And to the extent I can, providing positive energy to a system. And that positive energy, well, there's lots of ways to manifest it. It can be a kind word. It can be a kind gesture. It could be teaching a class, which I've been known to do, and trying to do just a really good job in the class. As a side point, my kids once asked me why I like teaching so much. I said, well, you can see learning in people. And one of my kids like, you can't see learning. I'm like, actually, you can. There's a moment when you can see the light bulb proverbially go off in someone's mind and their body language changes and their demeanor changes. And you know that there was a concept that they were struggling with and they got it. It can be technical. It can be, I used to teach a lot of very technical classes like advanced C++ or, you know, advanced small talk. And, or they could be more softer skills, like how do I run a stand-up in Scrum, or how do I really facilitate a retrospective that's on a very tough topic? It doesn't matter. What matters is that you can see that actual change in the learning. And that's an example of a physical manifestation of a positive energy in a system.
Oh, I love that. And I love that there's just, like you said, so many different ways that can show up. It almost leaves you as a person who is striving to do that limitless. The systems are limitless and the boundaries of how you can provide that energy are limitless as long as they're meeting that need. So I think that's pretty fantastic. So tell us a little bit about sort of what that has looked like lately and how does that relate to budgeting? Because I feel like, I don't know, how can you participate in budgeting? Don't the bosses do that? Ha ha.
Yeah. Well, let's pick a garbage process called budgeting and see if we can make it not garbage.
Yay.
So I've been looking at how groups make decisions for a very long time. And among the areas I've looked at how people make decisions is in priorities. I'm known in the Agile community, which you're somewhat associated with, to be lightly, is innovation games. And if you actually look at innovation games, three of the games are associated with prioritization. And so prioritization is in the, I know we call it ordering in the Scrum backlog now, but prioritization is super clear or super clearly important, but very hard to do. So we employ a lot of mechanisms to help us prioritize, or the act of prioritizing. And budgeting is a form of priorities, right? Because I have more initiatives than I can fund. In fact, if we leverage what you said about boundlessness or infinite space, if you go to a marketing team and say, hey, give us how many ideas you can stand about how to do better marketing, they'll give you an infinite number of ideas because human potential is unbounded. But human resources and actual financial resources of a firm are bounded. And so the act of allocating money in a portfolio setting is an act of setting a priority, because you are making financial allocations or investment decisions. The question is, can we do that in a way that isn't the bosses doing it and is more collaborative, is more energy producing, and is more positive in terms of the interactions and the outcomes? And that's where participatory budgeting comes in. And this is a very broad term. And I'll use the way we like to say it more simply, just PB. My kids call it the peanut butter process. So we've got PB. And PB at work gets expressed as, I have a amount of money I can invest against some initiatives. How do I do it? So in the work context, we would actually use allocations of the real budget across the participants. So let's say my budget is $24 million and I've got $32 million in possible initiatives. So I've got to make my investments against those initiatives. Now, in the normal or traditional form of doing that, the boss would make the decision, or the bosses would collaborate in a small group and make the decisions. And then they kind of tell what the results are. And that misses out on all of the wisdom and all the power and all of the insights of the organization. So what we do in participatory budgeting is we assemble a large number of small groups. So the first guiding principle is, humans do not collaborate in large groups. And we know this for a very long time. This has been decades and decades of research. But the optimal group size is somewhere between 4 and 8. So let's pick 6. So we take 6 people into that budgeting process, and we give each person $4 million of the budget. This is virtual money, but it represents the real money that's available. And we have a simple forum where we say, look, there's $32 million of potential spend. Each of you have $4 million. Fund the proposals that you want, or fund the initiatives you want. And hey, if you run out of money, or if the initiative costs more than $4 million, you have to convince people to join you. So you take an argument into a collaboration, and then you look at the intensities and the relationships that form and the ways in which people create coalitions within the group of 6. And if you do that over enough small groups within the organization, you can aggregate the results of the small groups, and you can see very clear patterns. We did a project years ago for a company called PayU, which is a payment processor like PayPal in Europe. And they had a set of initiatives. And in this, I'll go with a number. It was about 22 initiatives. And we had 6 tables of directors, senior directors, and VPs, each organized into groups of 6 or 7 doing this activity. Well, when 6 of 6 tables fund a project, it's kind of important. And when 0 of 6 tables choose not to fund something, you have confidence that it's not as important as the other items. And then what you start to look at is, beyond the obvious, these are funded, you get much greater insights into what's important to the group and why something should be funded.
So I'm realizing that I actually, prior to even knowing what this was called, have done something similar with organizations. And I'll just add, yes, and one of the things also really cool out of it is people start trying to like organically split stories or, you know, whatever initiatives, because we don't have enough money for, you know, the way that we imagined it. But if we think about it differently, we could get a slice of value, you know, with the money that we have, which is so practical. Like, absolutely. You really do have a finite amount of money.
Yeah, there's a number of very positive things. Let's keep building. In the corporate world, this is actually a mechanism for negotiating scope to value. I really want to do this initiative, but the way it's written, it seems like it's too much money for the value. Can we split it and we'll still fund it? And what we're after here is that I have a term called a zombie initiative. And a zombie initiative is an initiative that gets funded where everyone knows going in that you don't have enough money or resources to complete it. And in the traditional world of budgeting, when the boss makes the decision, if you will, without that input in the group, there's no corrective mechanism for the person who fed the boss the information, kind of, you know, fudging the numbers a little bit so their project gets chosen. But in these collaborative forums, what we have found, and companies like Cisco or eBay, we had this phenomena where people would look at the list of initiatives and say, Melissa, your initiative, that's not going to cost $8 million. Look, if you slice it this way, we can get real value for four. Oh, okay. And then when, you know, some other person, Satish, are you kidding me? There's no way you can do that data warehouse upgrade for $6 million. Don't fool us. We've been through data. Remember the last year? You need $8 million and you know it. So now put the right number in. And now let's, so what you actually find is that the openness and the transparency allows groups to normalize based on their experience what the real money is in a way that ensures that what is funded is more believable. I'm not going to say it's more accurate, but it is a more believable, and in many ways it is a more accurate number because you're getting the wisdom in. And so part of my career has been helping bring this process into corporate organizations, also cities, to help the citizens engage in their budgeting choices. And that experiences and some experiences in schools have led me to create First Route, which is bringing participatory budgeting into schools to teach our children the life skills they need with respect to financial literacy, civic engagement, and design thinking. Now, it's a slightly different process, and I'll explain some of the differences in a bit. But the underlying or the broader participatory budgeting process is something that is appropriate for any group of people who need to make a decision about shared resources.
So I want to ask, before we get to the kids, about the cities.
Sure.
Were there any differences in like how they approached it or the politics, or was it quite similar to the same thing that you had seen in, you know, typical organizations?
Well, politics always exists. And sometimes we use the word politics and we have this kind of negative overhang. I'm also want to introduce into the language that we use the positive version of politics, which is statesmanship. Mm-hmm. When you use the word statesmanship, you think of someone who really does represent the interest of the group, trusted. And we tend to use the word politics with a bit of a negative overhang. And it's kind of earned that, unfortunately. So in both civic life and in corporate life, there are statesmen and there are politicians. Now, in our work in cities, I tended to work in cities when the cities were in debt crisis or were dealing with deficits. So in that regard, we design a slightly different participatory budgeting program. I want you to imagine in the corporate world, you have a budget coming in. So really it's about funding something. And that's often associated with a economic model of zero-based budgeting. Everything starts at zero. What do I fund? Okay. In cities, especially if I'm dealing with a deficit, I don't have money to fund something new. So what we do is we create green sheets and red sheets. The green sheets are desirable items to fund. The red sheets are programs that we agree to cut. And by cutting those programs, we free capacity to fund something new. And when we have that small group, we still have a small group interactions, we make the actual interaction extremely challenging. What we tell people is to have agreement on a red sheet item, the group must unanimously agree. All members of the group have to agree to cut something. Once it's cut, the money is distributed evenly in the group, and now you can allocate it as you wish. And that is a very hard bar, but it creates very durable results that are reflective of the population in the city participating. And we have found that that's a very effective mechanism to gain insight into what cities can cut. Now, I am talking abstractly, so let me give you a couple of concrete examples. In San Jose, California, we did this process, and one of the items that was cut was the police helicopter, because what we found was that the helicopters are typically used in high-speed chases at night. And what was happening is you'd get car accidents or even pedestrians being killed in one case by a police helicopter high-speed car chase, when in reality, the citizens were like, look, we'd rather let the criminal go than force a high-speed car chase through our city streets at night. Wow. So there's a broad technique of participatory budgeting that you can tailor a little bit to these different circumstances to enable groups to make better decisions. And that's what we're looking for. We're not holding it up to some standard and saying this is or this isn't participatory budgeting. We're instead saying, here's this process with a couple of flavors or variations. How can we really use that to help a group make a much better decision?
So I have to ask, in order to do something like this, I mean, you have to have the leaders who would typically be, you know, authorized to make these decisions. There has to be a willingness, like there has to be a desire to involve either the employees, or I'm actually even more like impressed and baffled by the city leaders who are willing to let citizens step into that process.
And that's a valid point. I mean, you don't get married on the first date typically. So trust is allowed to be built. And I'm sure you've talked about trust in other podcasts, but we act like trust starts at a certain place and is relatively static. And of course, we construct a place of trust that's very high. That's not how it works, right? People build trust through a shared transactional memory system of interactions. And so, you know, the question in the Agile community or other communities, like, what makes a team a team? Well, a team is a shared transactional memory system of predicted behavior based on prior experiences. So if I have a new team and I'm not used to working with you, I don't know how you're going to behave. It's through time I trust and build. So in participatory budgeting, depending on the culture of the organization, a very safe and trustworthy way to build the process is to use it as an advisory function. So, for example, let's take a corporation who wants to make faster decisions better. Participatory budgeting will help them, but they may not be at the point where they're just ready to turn over the budgets to the individual teams. So in those cases, we use it as an advisory process. And we say, look, the leaders, you still have the decision. How about we go get some feedback from the employees and see what they would do and see what they would think? Oh, I know what my employees want. Well, great. Then you're getting confirming evidence. And many times the leaders that we work with do have a very good handle on what the employees need, but those outliers are super valuable. Same thing with the city. We started working in San Jose in 2011 in an advisory capacity. And after 3 years of the city building trust, we actually started working with districts in the city that were given real money from the city in the district under their control completely. Now, again, this process changes a little because if I'm using it, participatory budgeting in an advisory role, the city would be preparing the content for the citizens to assess. When you start and you dial the knob to full control on the citizens, well, that means they come up with the ideas. So now you're invoking in more design thinking practices. You're asking the citizens to go into their neighborhoods, canvas their neighborhoods. You have $250,000 to improve your neighborhood. What are you going to do? I don't know. I got to go out, talk with other people. So you support them with activities that they can engage, but the citizens are responsible for creating the raw proposals and then using design thinking to refine those proposals into something that can be put into a ballot. Now the city does have some oversight. For example, proposals may need to be reviewed to be acceptable from a permitting standpoint or from a given department. But in general, you try and have the citizens in charge of those proposals. And it's that process that we bring into the school environment.
Okay, I cannot wait to hear about that, but I do have to ask one more question.
Sure.
Around sort of how, I don't know, maybe I'll own it. It's probably not a question. It's just a comment. I cannot imagine a scenario where you have involved your, either your employees or your citizens in something like this, that they don't become like the biggest champions of these things that they have helped to decide and helped to fund and found the money for. And, you know, so I have to imagine that you see like an incredible amount of engagement as a result of this. And I think that's what leaders miss sometimes.
Yeah. We usually tell people, and we had some data at Contenio where it takes a little bit longer to make these decisions, but we can cut the time from decision to execution to near zero. So let's say in the old world, the leader and their team met as a team and made the budget decision. And now they've got to spend 2 to 4 months explaining to everyone why it was the right decision and going, why did you choose this initiative? Well, let me explain and blah, 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 versus the PB process where you might need to spend 2 to 3 weeks preparing the content and material and getting it out to the employees, doing the forums and then collecting the results and producing the results and analyzing the results. That's going to take a little bit of time. So let's say that in the traditional model, you spend a week as a leadership team making the decision and 2 to 4 months explaining it and convincing people to get behind it versus the PB process, which is going to be 3 to 4 weeks to make the decision. And then you're ready to execute precisely because of what you said, precisely because the engagement and ownership on that initiative is so strong that the employees are behind it.
Well, and also there's this implied learning that comes with being able to make a decision like that, which carries on beyond just that decision. Like, you know, I've been in situations where we really educated employees on, even if it wasn't quite participatory budgeting, we took them through what a P&L looked like. Like, yeah. These are the things that matter when we're making these decisions. So even more so with PB, I'm sure it's a continuous process, but like once you've gotten through that initial push, they still have all of that information in their mind when they're making day-to-day decisions. Well, how can I cut waste so that we have more money in the next cycle? You know, like I can see how empowering this would be, but how good for the business this would be.
Absolutely. And that carries over into the political sector with cities. And then what I started to do, and it was around 2015, is I started to experiment with my kids, who some of them were in middle school. I started to experiment doing the same process in schools. Create ideas, shape them into proposals. And it was amazing what the kids would do. First, what was predictable was the adults thought they would waste the money. Oh, they're just going to buy a party or they're just going to do this. And the kids never do. And so the very first year we did a participatory budgeting program in Sunnyvale Middle School, the kids ended up buying a LK water bottle refilling station to replace their water fountain so they could fill their water bottles while they're getting a drink and be more green when they're outside playing in the playground. Like, okay, come on, adults. And then one year they bought a 3D printer, and I just started to really like what was happening. And not to be denied, there were participatory budgeting programs popping up in schools across America in little isolated scenarios. And that was really exciting stuff. Well, the world came to pass where I was able to sell Contenio to Scaled Agile, and that transition was great. But when COVID hit, I could see that all of the PB programs that were being done in school, which were almost always in person, were dropping now. They were stopping, and students were not able to get the benefit of this incredible technique. And so I felt a calling, and the calling was to start another company and bring participatory budgeting in schools, but adjust the process a bit so that we could really emphasize the life skills of financial literacy, civic engagement, and design thinking. And also, to be very candid, try to combat the horrible experiences, especially around civics, that you get in traditional social media, which, you know, Facebook makes more money by creating divisions among people rather than uniting them. And I do believe that we, as people who create software solutions for the world, have a responsibility to create software solutions that uplift humanity, not tear it apart. And I am very committed to that. And participatory budgeting is a means by which we can work with schools and give children of all ages a positive experience that's uplifting and that shows the power of collaboration through a process that's supported and endorsed by teachers and other educators.
That is so cool. So walk us through just a little bit of like, what does that actually look like in the classroom? And, you know, and is it typically in middle schools or high schools or all ages?
All ages. We've done elementary, middle, and high schools in our software. So let's take a step back. The first and most important element of our program is that it's real money under the control of the kids. And the only thing we walk away from is if it's not real money. Now, it doesn't have to be a lot of money, right? You're dealing with kids, right? When you talk about schools and adults, they're thinking like, oh, I need a new gymnasium, or I need a new track, and that's like $300,000 or $500,000, or I need new lighting. Like, we need all that. Like, I don't want to discount that. But this is an educational program for kids. And so the amount of money we need for the kids is usually between $2,000 and $10,000. And we can acquire those funds from the principal, from ESSER funds, which is part of the recent CARES Act from the Biden administration, from PTAs and PTOs, from corporate social responsibility programs, from philanthropic organizations. So we can help schools raise a few thousand bucks. Now, and that's the starting condition. Now there's a 5D PB process. So there's 5 Ds. The first D is discover. Like in the city version of the program, the kids go into the school and they discover opportunities for making their school better. They can take photos of infrastructure that needs to be rebuilt. They can talk to the other kids. They can talk to the teachers. Those get boiled down typically into a theme. And let's say the theme is a better school experience or a better academic experience. Now, the second phase is dream. The kids do open-ended divergent thinking using design thinking techniques, and they dream about what could be better. Oh, what would be better in the school experience? Let's redo the chemistry lab. Or let's get 3D printers for the art lab. Or let's get a kiln. Okay, no restrictions. The next phase is design. And we use design thinking techniques to create a raw idea into something that's desirable, viable, feasible, and sustainable. So desirable. Who would benefit if we got a kiln? Who would desire that? Feasible. Can we afford it? Viable. Is it possible? Like, you may want a kiln and you may have enough money, but there may not be physical space in the school. It's not viable. And then sustainable. Once I get a kiln, will I have an ongoing budget or an ongoing cost issue? And notice that what's happening is, as each of these phases are going, we have opportunities to teach. So our financial literacy curriculum in the dream stage talks with kids about dreaming about their career. What kind of career could you have? Design stage. Okay, if that's the kind of career you want, what do you need to achieve that career? If you want to go into military service, that's great. Are you doing the things in your life that would prepare you for military service? Oh, if you want to go into health or, you know, public service, et cetera. After the design phase, we have a set of concrete proposals that can be voted on by the students. They all fit the budget. They all meet the school guidelines, and the school creates a ballot. So the fourth phase is decide. The students vote. Now, in our particular application, we don't do exactly the same level of sophistication that we do in business or in the cities, meaning the items are fixed cost and the voting is at present not collaborative. It's very simple, very direct. It's designed to fit into the school environment. So the kids make their individual vote. The vote is ratified. And then the fifth D is due. The students, to the extent that they can, start doing the work. And then we add in adults in that process. So it's discover, dream, design, decide, and do. And this five-step or five-phase program that typically takes about 2 to 3 months, and it's supported by optional curricula. So you can use our program with an existing curriculum, or you can use our program with our integrated curriculum. The curriculum is optional, but it supports it. And it's amazing.
I would have loved this in school. I feel like this is like what a lot of clubs try to do, but, you know, like, I don't know, you have Key Club and you have, you know, these like student council, but they don't always have the structure and, you know, and just the support. And I think what you're providing is kind of a little bit of both of those things. What's the coolest thing, in your opinion, that you've seen kids choose?
Yeah, I get that question every now and then. And I want to point out that it's a biased question because it's my opinion. Sure. And one of the things that I think is super important about our program is we have no influence and we don't tell the kids what to do. And that's what's kind of shocking to many of the kids is they keep on waiting for, like, well, where's the ad or where's the thing that's going to tell us what's good or bad? And I always tell them, look, this is your money. I mean, there are some guidelines that you have to follow, but I will tell you some of the things that touched my heart being Wild Hearts at Work. We worked with a school in Queens, New York, in a low-income part of Queens, the Academy of American Studies, and they had a $2,000 budget. And I'm a benefit corporation, so a part of our profit goes to fund schools. So we granted them $2,000 to run their program. And it was a very impactful result. The number one item was more feminine care hygiene products for the girls' bathroom. And I remember bringing that to my family and my wife, who is so fantastic. She smiles. She's like, "Oh, honey," she's like, "you are so clueless. First, you know, you're an engineer and you're a man." And I said, "What?" We're like, what? She's like, "Look, if you're a young woman," and she said, "I'll take that back. If you're any woman and you're menstruating and you don't have the right feminine care hygiene products, you're not going to go to work. You're not going to go to school." So yeah, the politicians can talk about 3D printers and STEM education and getting tablets, but these kids knew what they needed and that's what they bought. And what's heart-touching about that is heartwarming. I don't know, heart touching, whatever. Is it the school voted for that? Boys, the school voted for that. And
yeah.
And so that one was a big impact for me. We see a lot of the kids being very sensitive to underserved population. Partly, I think, because we talk about it in our curriculum. We actually have a section on voting algorithm and voting algorithm design and how something can be more equitable or less equitable by design, and who votes and what power do the votes have. So we see in terms of desirability of proposals when we're scoring, when the kids are scoring proposals, does it affect everyone in the school or does it affect a subset of the school? If it affects a subset of the school, is it a subset that is historically underserved? So we can use our money to lift people up. And we see that in one school, they funded driving lesson scholarships for the kids who couldn't afford the driving lessons in their school.
It's just so like they're so much closer to the needs, you know. Like, I know that my husband was a teacher for 18 years. Teachers are close to it too. But these kids are like in it, right? They're in it with their friends and they're seeing the need. And I
Something as simple as bathroom supplies, like we talked about. The teachers don't, and sometimes people use this example in a twisted way. And I want to stop that now. People are like, oh, that just proves that our teachers don't know what's going on. No, that's not true. Teachers are great, but they don't go to the same bathrooms.
Right.
So how would they know? And this is like, we've known this for decades in work. You know, ask your frontline employees for their feedback precisely because they're the front line, right? I mean, so this is just the same manifestation of the principle in a different context. And, you know, I don't want to bore anyone on the podcast, but the kids are inventive and creative and they do really cool stuff and they do great stuff with the money.
Yeah. I have so much hope as a result of this generation that is coming behind us. My kids are so much more aware and so much more compassionate even than I was. And I mean, I'd like to think I was pretty compassionate and empathetic, but I mean,
I tell my kids the same thing. I grew up in a tough town outside of Buffalo and my kids are way nicer than you were.
Yeah. And they just know more. And then programs like yours, and we actually had John Miller with Agile Classrooms here. He's wonderful. For season one, talking about similar things in the sense that, you know, using Agile values and principles in the classroom teaches them these, you know, teamwork skills, prioritization, same life skills. So I think it's kind of wonderful and also maybe a little hilarious that like they're already better than us and we're teaching them to be even better than us. And I am here for it. Yeah. I'm so here for it.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, I feel like that is a good place to ask you if people want to learn more about this program, participatory budgeting in general, or just Luke and get in touch with you, where do they go?
They go to www.firstroot.co or they just type in FirstRoot and participatory budgeting into their search engine browser and it will find us. We're easy to find.
Awesome. And are you, I mean, I assume that you're actively doing new programs with schools. So if someone has, you know,
if someone on the podcast wants to get involved and they're a parent, the easiest way to get involved is just make a small commitment to funding a PB program in your school. And then we can come to the school and say, look, we've got a small amount of money coming in. We will use that as a seed. We'll fundraise. And we'll build out this program and let's bring it into the school. So parents have an enormous opportunity to make a positive change in the schools.
Absolutely. That's so cool. That is so, so cool. All right. Well, first, before we wrap up, I have a final question that I have asked every guest so far this season. And it is, I think it's a fun question. We'll just say that. A lot of different people listen to this podcast. And my question for you is, when you heard Wild Hearts at Work as the title of the podcast, what did that mean to you? What did it strike you? What does it mean to be a wild heart at work?
I felt when I saw Wild Hearts at Work, I felt a certain kinship because I don't think of myself as a wild heart. I think of myself as following my heart. And when I think when you follow your heart, it can appear to others that you're wild because you're going to do your thing and you're not doing your thing for validation of other people. You're doing your thing because you're following your heart. And I remember at times the Agile community, especially that's where I'm known, looking at me a little askew going like, yeah, we like this guy, but sometimes he's a little different. And it was the charitable way to say that we didn't understand him and he's the wild heart, but he's following his heart. And I think that's how I interpret it. The wild heart at work is just follow your heart. Some people will interpret it as wild and that's okay.
I love that. I love that so much. Well, Luke, first of all, obviously, thank you for coming on the podcast. It's been super fun just hearing what you're up to. But moreover, just thank you for the work that you're doing. I think it's so important, not only what we're teaching kids, but also just what it's giving them in the process of learning, which is, you know, these contributions to their experience at school. So thank you for coming and thank you for what you're doing in the world.
Thank you.
Awesome. And to you, my friends, thank you for coming back week after week and listening to Wild Hearts at Work. I am so happy to be here with you week after week and talking about the things that help us, I don't know, rebel a little bit and be wild. And so just a reminder, if you like what you hear, tell your grandmother, tell your aunts, your uncles, like, share, subscribe. But most importantly, just keep coming back because I hope we're continuing to give you great content. And remember, I'm going to keep saying this, even though it is so awkward. We do have a Patreon in which you can support the show if you are so inspired. So until next time, dear hearts, stay wild.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of Wild Hearts at Work. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe and share. For more resources and to connect with Melissa, visit melissaboggs.com. Also, if you or someone you know is doing great work in a wild way, get in touch about being a guest on the show. Until next time.